Well, thank God for food. It's a way to travel the globe without a plane ticket or a space in MIQ. The people from Atlas Obscura, who created a global phenomenon by finding weird and wonderful attractions around the world, now go off the culinary beaten track to find strange and unusual edible wonders of the world. Beer made from the fog of the Chilean Atacama Desert. Pizza made in a termite hill oven. Strange traditions, experiences, and creative cooking are on the menu in Gastro Obscura, a food adventurer's guide. And Dylan Thuris is the co-founder and creative director of Atlas Obscura and co-editor of Gastro Obscura. He joins me now. Hi there, Dylan.
Hey, Jesse. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, nice to chat to you. And the first clue, this isn't your usual food book, comes right at the beginning. It says not everything in here should be eaten. Some of the foods in this book are a wonder to learn about, but do harm to partake in. Did you discover that lesson firsthand?
No. Well, I definitely have tried some things that I was happy to try once, but not eager to run back to. But I think part of the point of that whole introduction is to help people approach this book. It's not a cookbook, and it's not even a bucket list of foods you must eat. It is a way of exploring the incredible diversity and ingenuity of food around the world. So, you know, that's sort of what we were looking for, was stories that surprised you about food history, about ingredients, you know, even restaurants, incredible places where you can get interesting food items. So, yeah, that we were kind of trying to prepare people for what they were in for.
Yeah, and it's a way of connecting too, right? Quite a deep way of connecting with the world, thinking about and sometimes eating food.
Yeah, I mean, food and travel obviously go together hand in hand. Every time you go somewhere, one of the ways you explore it is through your food and drink. And we just realized that all of these dishes that sometimes we eat every day without even thinking about, some of them, they have incredible stories, and they're stories of, you know, culture, history, of collisions of different food cultures producing some new kind of dish, and that they're just another entry point to exploring the world. One of the stories we tell in the book that surprised me was the story of Pad Thai, which I was very, you know, accustomed to eating and didn't really actually give very much thought to. But in fact, Pad Thai was kind of invented by the dictator of Thailand in the 1930s and 40s. And he wanted to kind of create a national identity for what was then Siam. And he renamed Thailand. And that was part of his campaign, was to invent this dish that became sort of by force the national dish of Thailand. And sort of in knowing that changes, you know, what it is to eat a dish. And so that's sort of true of a lot of the things in the book.
Yeah, I think there was an economic reason for that as well, because he worked out that rice noodles made the rice go further than eating just the rice by itself. In fact, a lot of breakthroughs come through that, what you might call the food of poverty. I'm thinking about some of those really strong flavors in Italy. And in fact, you in your book point out that fish sauce, which is we tend to think of as a Southeast Asian ingredient, actually traces back to Roman times.
Yeah, we have a nice little spread of a map of the, it was called garum in Rome. And it was basically their ketchup, mustard, Worcestershire sauce combined. It was the condiment for all occasions. Something like, you know, 4 out of 5 recipes in you know, big old Roman cookbooks call for garum in some way or another. And yeah, it was a hugely popular and important ingredient. But they could also make other sauces out of it. You could make a sweet sauce using fish sauce, but then adding honey and vinegar and herbs. And so there was sort of almost like many different sauces flowed from that fish sauce.
The British may claim the sandwich because of the Earl of Sandwich, although you trace it back to 200 BC to China, I think.
That's right. It's hard to put a claim for sure on what is the earliest possible sandwich, but we make a guess at it. So Ruijia Jiamo in China is basically this kind of, it translates to meat in bread, which is in a way what, you know, pretty good definition of a sandwich or a hamburger. And so it is exactly that. It's now, there's made in a lot of different ways. You can get sort of a a halal version because the region in which it's made has a Muslim population, or a lamb version is there. You can get it in pork is kind of the standard version, but it's delicious. And it's made with a ton of spices. So it's kind of got a different flavor profile than you might think of as a normal sandwich. It's got that kind of gingery, Szechuan peppercorn, cinnamon, cumin flavors going on, but really good, basically stewed pork belly and little folded buns. Delicious.
Okay, you're definitely going to make people hungry today. Avocado is ubiquitous in 2021, although there's some interesting, I guess, evolutionary information here as to why avocado seeds are so big.
Well, if you stop and think about it, the mystery is right in front of you, because so most fruits, part of the way they're distributed, if the seeds are too big to be sort of blown on the wind, then one of the major ways they're distributed is by birds or other animals eating them and then depositing them wherever they go. But of course, an avocado seed is gigantic, and it's really not something you can imagine a bird eating. And there actually aren't a ton of animals that you can imagine comfortably swallowing an avocado seed. But the giant ground sloth, which was something like 12 feet tall when it stood up on its hind legs, certainly was one. And it was still around doing that all over South America when humans arrived in the region. Wow. And of course, we, as we did in many places, you know, basically hunted them into extinction, these sort of delightful, very, you know, full of food megafauna. But at the same time, so in that moment, the avocado could have gone extinct, but human beings also happened to realize that they were sort of interested in keeping this delicious, fatty fruit around themselves, and then they propagated it. So pretty early on, we actually took over the propagation as human beings from the ground sloths.
Amazing. This would be such a great gift for someone who's a foodie, by the way. The book is full of these interesting facts. It's called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. And I'm talking to Dylan Thuris. Dylan, you travel the world continent by continent in search of food. Does everyone and every culture have a sweet tooth?
Well, it varies place to place. And there are interesting places where people amend their sweet tooth or have a way of kind of adjusting it. So one of the entries in the book that is actually, it's really fun to try. I tried this with my son, he's six, is something called a miracle berry. So in West Africa, for hundreds, thousands of years, people have been eating this berry right before they were going to eat either sour bread or drink, you know, this very sour wine. And it's because the berry transformed your taste buds so that sour foods tasted sweet. And it would turn these things that otherwise were a little bit unpalatable into really delicious treats. And it's still true now. You eat one of these berries and then you eat a lemon or a lime and it tastes kind of almost candy-like. And so Americans have more of a sweet tooth than almost anywhere. The Westerners in general, but people do have a taste for sweet, really, the world over.
Bugs is one of the most challenging thing for Westerners to get their head around. And actually, I think this is at the extreme end even of bugs. Maggot cheese. Did you try it?
This is one food I actually have yet to try. And I would try, although it comes with a little sort of safety warning, because, eaten traditionally, the maggots, they're inserted into this cheese. Basically, a hole is made in a normal rind of cheese. And then it's done so that a fly can lay its eggs. And then the eggs, basically, they sort of almost act as a fermenting process. And they sort of change the cheese, they change the flavor, turns into sort of a gorgonzola flavor, and it gets kind of creamy. But then traditionally, it's eaten with the live maggots. You can eat it without the live maggots, but traditionally it isn't. But the live maggots, you know, you got to eat them. You got to chew them up. And if you don't, they can cause you problems down there. You don't want them wriggling around. So, I have yet to indulge in that particular delicacy. That's a Sardinian dish down in Italy.
Wow. While we're in Sardinia, by the way, I love this idea of the biannual trek to eat the rarest pasta in the world.
Yeah, I mean, the Threads of God pasta is really only produced by, a handful of women, five, maybe 3 to 5 women in the world really know how to make this pasta in the traditional manner. You can't even really make it by machine because people have tried and it doesn't really work. And it's this incredibly laborious process of sort of kneading and kneading and kneading the semolina flour and then stretching it out almost like to an angel hair pasta, but then even thinner into these absolutely gossamer threads. And they're kind of laid over each other in a grid pattern, and they form kind of a giant cracker that is usually cracked up and put into a soup. It's an immense amount of work for something that ends up in a kind of simple dish, but people make a kind of religious trek out to the women who know how to do this to honor this incredible pasta making tradition.
And what I love about it is it can't be replicated, right? The pasta companies have tried, even celebrity chef Jamie Oliver tried, and it broke them all.
Yeah, that's right. It's just like a thing that you have, because you have, part of it is the feel of the dough. It's the actual kind of texture of the dough in your hands. And if you don't have that sense, which these women have developed over years and years of doing this, you really get it wrong and you can't do it. You can't get it to be the right kind of consistency.
New Zealand has a couple of mentions in the book. One is in relation to something called, which I haven't run into here, but it must be available. According to your book, it's available. It's called the King's Ginger. What's the backstory to that?
Well, that's not particularly it's an English dish more than a New Zealand dish. Although I guess supposedly you can get it in New Zealand. It's got a kind of a great story. So, you know, King Edward the VII he loved driving around. This is like right at the turn of the century, so cars barely existed, but he loved riding around in his topless, you know, convertible car, sort of Model T style car. But his doctor, he was an older man at this point. His doctor was worried about him. So he made him a kind of special drink to keep his body warm while he did this. And so he invented the King's Ginger, which is basically brandy, ginger, honey, lemon. And it was specifically meant to be drunk while driving his car. So this is really there's no seatbelts. The king is drinking heavily while he drives around. This is a pre-safety era for sure. but they now make it, and you can buy it. You can buy a version.
The hangi, the Māori hangi, gets a mention. We're pretty familiar with those here, although I don't know that I've come across a special gunpowder rum, and that's actually made here, apparently. What's the secret recipe?
Well, this goes back to the famous, you know, if you ever have heard the word proof on a bottle of liquor, that has to do with this idea of basically proving that it's good alcohol, that it's high in alcohol. And this comes back to sailors who, at least the story is, had this practice of mixing gunpowder and liquor and then striking a match. Because if the wet gunpowder caught flame, it meant that there was enough liquor enough alcohol in the booze. And so this idea is like, that was proof that it was good. And that's the name. And so in honor of this idea of sort of, you know, sailors trying to test their rum with gunpowder, a rum manufacturer in New Zealand called Smoke and Oakum, they made a rum that mixes in actually a little bit of saltpeter. So that's an element of traditional gunpowder. It's got a little bit of sulfur, a little bit of charcoal, and then it's got bits of tobacco and chili peppers, and sort of make this kind of heady, smoky brew. And it's quite good. It's delicious.
I know you didn't intend this book to be a bucket list, but, you know, there's going to be a few Kiwis thinking, oh, I have to give this stuff a try. Mind you, if we get our... If we decide to eat oysters here, we'll probably get them from a fishmonger or even the ocean. I'm not sure I'd trust them from a vending machine.
Well, you'd have to go pretty far for that vending machine. Well, you have oysters right there, right? You have the Bluff oysters.
Indeed.
There's a whole New Zealand celebration about the Bluff oysters. Have you ever been out there or had Bluff oysters?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Bluff oysters. I haven't been to the Bluff Oyster Festival, which starts off okay, but then I think when the booze kicks in, it all gets a bit full on. But we're very proud of this delicacy.
Yeah. I don't know, that sounds fun to me. No, but yeah if you want to get your oysters not from the ocean or a festival, you can always go to France and get them from the oyster vending machine, where There are mollusks on offer 24 hours a day. And they're not, they're like reasonable. A dozen oysters is about $8. And, you know, they're freshly stocked. It's not like a bag of Doritos or something, which is in there for 2 years before you get it. Luckily they change them out.
Yeah. I should also mention a couple of foodstuffs which appear in the book, which aren't necessarily about eating the food. Like, you've got a sculptress who, when she sees butter, doesn't spread it on her bread. Instead, she turns it into something. Can you tell us a bit about this woman at the Minnesota State Fair?
Yeah, so I'm from Minnesota originally, and this is like every summer we would go to the state fair to watch women get their heads carved in 90-pound blocks of butter. And what I didn't realize at the time was that this is a tradition that goes way back. So in the mid late 1800s, basically people would carve or mold really butter on the roadside, and you'd buy a little piece of kind of molded butter, and it would be in the shape of a fruit or something interesting. But this woman, Caroline Shaw Brooks, realized that if she wanted to compete, her husband was out of work, and if she wanted to compete, that she decided she was going to sculpt elaborate works of butter. And they caught on. And then basically she got sort of noticed as a talent. And not long after, she was out carving butter in front of 2,000 people at a huge, like basically a concert, a butter carving concert. And she became world renowned for her butter carving. And she kind of started, in a way, this Midwestern tradition. She was from the Midwest. She sort of, you know, did this all around places like Iowa. And she started this Midwestern tradition that you can still see in state fairs all over the U.S. of butter carving. And so it's still amazing to go watch someone get their portrait carved in butter, their likeness made in butter. It's very cool.
I mentioned the pizzas cooked in termite hills. People can probably picture that and read more about it in the book. But maybe we could finish by talking about the novel way in which Alaska helps alleviate food insecurity.
Sure. I find this to be actually like an incredible program. So Alaska, you know, has a lot of large animals, and occasionally they get hit in the road. Like roadkill happens, you know, all over the world. But when you hit something like a moose, say, or an elk, I mean, you're talking about truly hundreds of pounds of potentially unspoiled meat. And so Alaska has something called the Roadkill Salvage Program, where basically you can call a dispatcher, and then the dispatcher will put a call out to basically citizens, other people who said that they're interested in taking those cadavers, the moose or the elk or deer that have been hit, and turning them into things like sausage or burgers. And, you know, people get there fast. They make sure that the you know, food is good to eat. The people who are a part of this are often hunters, so they can actually field dress the moose or whatever it is as needed. And obviously they don't, you know, they make sure that they're not taking anything they can't. But I actually find it to be quite a wonderful way of sort of making something good out of something bad and you know, being a kind of an efficient use of these animals.
Yeah. Have you got to try the Portuguese francesinha yet?
No. No. Here's the thing. I could make it at home, but I would actually like to eat it like in Portugal. It is a thing. Like, I would like to eat it in Porto, the city it comes from. And so I think I'm just going to hold out until I can go there. I don't want to eat as a second-rate version. I want to eat the sort of the true thing. So I'm biding my time.
A sandwich made from aged ham and steak and sausage covered in melted cheese, drenched in a beer, tomato and chili sauce, then simmered with a fried egg on top.
Who doesn't want that?
Congratulations on the book. It's a pleasure to talk to you today. You know, we often think we've seen it all when it comes to food. There's so much food porn on our TV screens, and most of us fancy ourselves in the kitchen now, but this one is full of new ideas and jaw-dropping moments. The book's called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide, and I've been speaking to the author, Dylan Thuris. Thanks, Dylan.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.